Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode.
Hello everybody, I'm Bill Barton from Barton Legal. Today I'm joined by Jim Smith from Farrakane, who's come all the way up from London to join me in person, which is a particular pleasure because many of these conversations I have are virtual. And there's a certain je ne sais quoi. You get a lovely vibe when you're with somebody. So, Jim, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Jim, as Bill kindly pointed out, and I do indeed work for Farrakane. We work with Bill on PR. So if you ever see an article with Bill's name on it or even Bill's LinkedIn, we might have had a small hand in some of that. So, that's, I suppose, me in a very much in a nutshell.
I think you're underplaying a statement. What Jim and his colleagues managed to do is make me look very erudite and intelligent on a regular basis. And also, Jim has been fantastic at finding opportunities with lots of legal and industry magazines where I can also somehow appear erudite and intelligent by writing articles. So, Jim, why PR?
That's a good question. I suppose I sort of fell into it in a way. So I studied history at university, and then I went back to do a master's in global history. And then I realised that I didn't like reading original documents enough to become an academic. So then I thought I might try my hand at studying law. So I went and did a postgraduate diploma in law. And I realised there that I actually didn't like studying law quite as much as all the other prospective lawyers. So I wasn't sure I saw a future there. What I ended up finding was that PR actually allowed me to bring quite a few of my interests together, not least I've always loved the news. And in fact, I also tried my hand at journalism for a while. So I've tried a few things. And so at Farrakane, we do a mixture of legal and property PR. Those are our bread and butter. We do a few other things, but those are the mainstays. And that's allowed me to kind of bring a few of my interests together. So my legal studies, such as they were, have come in handy. My enjoyment of writing has come in handy. My enjoyment of reading the news comes in very handy. That's sort of a key part of the job, actually. You're almost at times being paid to read the news for a living, which is an absolute pleasure. But I can't say I went into PR with a sort of burning ambition to become a PR professional, but In fact, I started in PR 2.5 years ago today.
All right.
And I've really, really enjoyed it. I think it's a fantastic job. So for anyone who enjoys the media, enjoys writing, reading, researching, I'd highly recommend it.
You always come across as incredibly knowledgeable, and you frequently raise with me, there's been a case or there's an act and we should be writing an article on it. And I'm interested that you did a history degree because it seems to me a lot of people I meet who've done history have developed. I'm not sure if it's because, do you do a lot of essay type writing?
You do quite a lot, yeah. That's the...
Okay. So people who've done history seem to have developed an ability for perspective. I don't know if that's because you're looking backwards. But also I suppose it's the... Is it the review of things that have gone on? Do you know what I mean? You have a perspective, but you also have an ability to write an opinion about things from an angle that is very readable, that is open. It draws you in. That's what I like.
Well, I'm going to steal from my father here, but he didn't even study history, but he said that you don't go to university to study history or English. He went to university to study law and is now a lawyer. So for him, that was a more natural progression.
Yeah.
But his argument was that what you're doing is learning the skill of analysis just dressed up, be that in history or English. And I think he was right about that, actually, that the skill you learn from a history degree or an English degree is to take a certain set of information, analyze it, and use that to produce something else that's useful, be that an essay or an exam answer. So it teaches you that skill to kind of digest information and then do something with it. And I think that's probably the skill that is fundamental to good PR.
Yeah, I think you do it very well. And how did you arrive? How did you choose Warwick? And I ask that because both of my sons, I've got twin boys, went to Warwick. So how did you choose Warwick from you were living slightly further south, but why Warwick over other places for history?
Before I answer, I'd say that when I chose Warwick, I was only 17, and I used that as mitigating circumstances. I chose on a whim because I hadn't chosen any, hadn't really decided where I wanted to go. I didn't have particularly strong feelings about any of the five universities I'd applied to. Mm. I mean, age 17, I confess to not knowing a huge amount about the world, and you're just presented with a list of possible choices.
Yeah.
And I thought Warwick looked like it had a really nice campus.
Which it does.
Yeah, very leafy, very green.
Lots of ducks and geese.
Yes, the ducks and the geese are a bit of a menace, actually, especially the geese. But I knew I wanted to go to a campus university, so I only applied to campus universities because I wasn't enthralled by the idea of living in the city, being from quite a small town. And then I sort of chose Warwick a bit on a whim, without a great deal of forethought. I ended up meeting some really, really good friends. A couple of very close friends from school also ended up there.
Okay.
One of them doing the same degree as me. So it worked out very well, but I hadn't actually even visited it until after I'd sort of made it my firm choice.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's brave.
I would say don't learn from me in that respect. Go and visit them before you choose.
Okay, Warwick's actually, the boys were there during COVID, and it's developed a lot. It's had a lot of investment from the automotive industry in Birmingham. But it's a pretty good campus in the Warwick Arts Centre, isn't it, and the rest. And I remember going to, it wouldn't have been Freshers, but it was, you know, whatever, the parents' visiting day. And the range of societies really made me laugh because they had a Yorkshire society and they had some other bizarre ones as well. But it was just, it was so different from when I went to do my degree that the only societies that existed were, you know, football and rugby. And suddenly there was just this plethora of weird and wonderful, you know, war games and all these others. Did you join a society? Is something you would want to admit to?
No, I think I sort of nominally joined a couple because there's a big sort of fair where you go around and you choose which societies you'd like to join. I think the sports teams are around there as well. So they're sort of picking out the people that look the most athletic and asking them to join. I was very briefly on the rowing team.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so I'm just over 2 meters tall, full height. And height is really the only skill you need to start rowing.
Oh, is that? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because obviously almost nobody comes with any rowing background.
Yeah.
So height is enough, and then they teach you how to do the rest. But I didn't stick with it for very long because it involves, I think, 5 a.m. starts in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
And they'd sort of make you work so hard that you had to drink salty water to get your electrolytes back up. My housemate, who did stick with rowing, used to regularly have sort of nosebleeds as a result. I mean, he was fit as a fiddle, but my university passions were more on the social side than the sporty side. So
yeah. You're not selling it to me at all.
So no.
I can remember when I was at Birmingham, and I'll say I went to a polytechnic, and my children never listened to this podcast. It'd be a massive guffaw at that. And I don't think I ever attended anything on a Thursday morning because it seemed to me a quite ridiculous thing of timetabling to put any lectures or any form of teaching on a Thursday morning when it was blindingly obvious that most of us were doing sport or some social activity on a Wednesday that completely precluded Thursday morning. You know?
Yeah, well, I had all of my seminars on a Thursday, so my Wednesday nights were quite quiet.
Oh, were they?
But I also realised that they didn't take registers for lectures. So my attendance there was a bit more spotty. But those were Monday to Wednesday, and then I was pretty good at turning up to my seminars.
Oh, well, you must have attended just in the right time, because when the boys were there, they took registers, and then they did, I think they had, there was 1 year of virtual teaching. Yeah, I'll say publicly, Warwick were not the best place or best caring university during COVID. I think, I don't know if others fared better. But then afterwards, there was a lot more regimentation of lectures, and now you can, the lectures are all filmed,
yeah,
and then sort of downloaded.
Yeah, they filmed out, so you could watch them back.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people did, rather than show up on the day, because, you know, you're a bunch of sort of 18, 19-year-olds who've been given your first lease of freedom. So I think people started preferring a lie-in to a 9 a.m. lecture.
Yeah, I can remember, not in all, but in some of our lectures, we sat at the back of the class and smoked, which is quite funny now to think that, you know, you could be in any form of lecture, you know, with your roll-ups. But anyway, so you nominally left university, but then you decided you wanted more education. But when you were doing your history degree, what were you thinking then? Not what were you thinking, but, you know, what was your sort of your plan? Because I did a law degree, and I did a law degree because I was going to do geography, and then I realised on going around to lots of universities way ago that the only thing I'd be able to do with a geography degree back then was teach, and I realised that I didn't want to be a teacher. And family had a long history of law, so it was really sort of, you know, I'll do law. And I just thought, at the end of the degree, I'll work something out, or I'll just be a solicitor, I'll be a lawyer. I really didn't think about it. Was that different for you?
Not massively. I mean, both of my parents, my father still is a lawyer, my mother was a lawyer, so...
You're under a lot of pressure.
Well, there was always that idea that if failing anything else, you could try your hand at being a lawyer, which sounds very disrespectful to what's a very difficult job. But it just felt like a sort of, there's always that natural step,
yeah,
to follow in your parents' footsteps, which I suppose is probably shared by everyone whose parents do anything.
Yeah, I think.
I had ambitions of being a writer. I thought I would be the sort of next Tolkien. I spent a lot of my time at university writing a fantasy novel that I still tinker with occasionally, but everything I wrote when I was at university was pretty terrible, pretty ordinary stuff. But that's sort of what I imagined I would do. And then as I got slightly older, I realised that having a bit of structure and a monthly wage was
quite attractive.
Was quite nice.
Well, yeah. I admire your high aspirations. I also admire your choice of Tolkien, one of my favourite authors. So is your novel still a work in progress, or very much a not?
Loosely. I've written or worked on sort of two other novels as well. I don't know how familiar you are with the publisher Mills and Boon.
I am.
Yeah,
I wrote. Not, you know,
not personally, but you're aware of them.
I know them. I can't. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've ever read a Mills and Boon book. That's terrible, really. I mean,
you've not missed much. I've read, I think, six, because my mother suggested to me that it would be worth writing sort of genre fiction.
Okay.
Something
like that. Yeah.
Something quite short, potentially a bit more commercial.
Yes.
And also, it's just achievable to say, well, I've written this and yeah, it's finished. So she suggested writing some historical romance. And I thought that this was when I'd moved to London, but I was waiting to start studying the law. So I had sort of a spare 4 or 5 months, say.
Yeah.
So I read 5 or 6 Mills and Boon historical romances, realised that they were all pretty similar.
Thought you could knock one of these out.
And wrote one myself. I chose the Byzantine Empire as my setting, which in retrospect, I think was a mistake. Slightly too niche, but that is what I'd written my undergraduate and postgraduate dissertations on.
Yeah.
So I thought I won't need to do any research. And then I think, looking back on it, perhaps like the Highlands or the Viking era, or maybe something in the Roman times,
might have been easier for a reader.
Had a wider appeal. but I submitted that actually to the publisher, and I got some nice feedback, which was quite encouraging. So then I started working on another one, which was set in the sort of aftermath of the English Civil War, which I'm still working on that one now, say 2 or 3 years down the line. That's sort of my current hobby, if you will.
I think that's a really, really interesting thing, because it's different from your work, but I can see how it interplays with your work. Also, the fact that even in your hobby, the fact that you had to do the research, you know, to read Mills and Boon in order to start writing something.
Well, I think it's before you start writing anything, you should try reading previous examples of it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what's the saying that the one that ends with great artists steal, effectively.
Okay.
I think you can basically steal anything and put it in your own words if you're a dab hand at writing, or even, you know, any good at all. You can just twist it around a bit, if that makes sense. So, I almost feel like a lot of fiction, a lot of newspaper columns, etc., is heavily influenced by what went before.
Yeah. What do you think? I can't think of a name, but I was reading it in The Guardian the other day. I think, is she Japanese? And she wrote her first novel and then admitted that it was also co-authored by AI, and has since sort of said, well, actually, it was only, you know, 5% or something. Do you think that's a good way for books or authors to go, where part of a book is actually written by AI?
No, I don't. On the basis that what is good about writing is it's your work. So even if you are, and I've probably, you know, slightly overstated the extent to which I think you can and should steal from other people's writing.
I know what you mean.
It's your own, you know, it's always going to be your own take on it, whereas AI really is just scraping other people's work. But, I mean, I suppose, you know, if you're using it to edit your work or to provide some suggestions, then is that so different from using a human editor? I don't know. It's probably a question of degrees as to how much AI we feel comfortable. But what you wouldn't want, or what I don't see the point is an AI novel.
No. But I think it's an interesting thing. And the reason I raised it is because I say that the area of law I'm in is reasonably safe from AI. There are advances that you make with technology in terms of documentation and the rest. We have, I think, as you know, we sought to draft a contract with AI, and it could do very simplistic clauses, but anything that was particularly specific, it struggled with. The structure was very simple, and I don't think it had the complexity. But your PR is an area where, you know, a lot of people are not coming to a firm with your skill and knowledge and experience, and are just using sort of AI, ChatGPT or whatever. Do you think that is a threat to sort of you, to the industry of PR, or do you think it's...
I don't think so. I always feel like people can sometimes forget that the second half of PR is relations.
Hmm.
So I would say that actually most of my job is having either relationships with journalists or relationships with clients. The additional skills of writing or researching, etc., you know, AI probably inevitably will have a role to play there. But I don't think it can replace the human interactions, which are actually probably central to the job. So I wouldn't say that AI is really a threat. It's more of a probably actually a productivity aid, as it is in a lot of different industries, rather than something that will replace people.
Mm.
But I suppose only time will tell.
Yeah, I think that's a very good answer, because, as you say, PR is relations. And certainly in terms of, you know, my experience with you and your colleagues, I would say a very big part is the relationship, the knowledge that you have made the effort to learn about me, about our company, but also the broad contacts that you have and the way that you've introduced me, us to people, and to a limited degree, vice versa. That really can't be replaced by AI, can it?
No, I don't think so at all. And I don't think people want it to be either. I always think the sort of great limit on AI will be that how much interest is there in, you know, you asking AI to write me an email, me asking AI to read it and write you one back. What's the point in that? We might as well have not emailed each other.
Yeah.
And that's as simple as sending two emails. So I don't actually know to what extent AI will ever kind of break into that aspect of the business world, whatever your industry is, because I think people actually like speaking with and dealing with other people.
And do you see PR that you, as you say, you're doing sort of property law. Is PR very different, or is it just the background information when you're working in other areas? So you're doing, you know, PR for a government. What would you do? What would you do for the current government? You know, PR.
Well, a few things. Honestly, I don't know. I don't know what, you know, working in a government comms department is like well enough to really answer that question in a way that will be sort of useful or informative to your... My sister actually worked in the comms department for Public Health England.
Oh, right,
okay. And she started 2 weeks before the pandemic. But I think, you know, there's PR in, you know, almost every industry, music PR, film PR.
Yeah.
But I think really you'd have to ask someone that works in those sectors, because I wouldn't want to speak.
Do you have sort of PR conferences where all these different genre of PR get together? Like, I mean, we have, you know, IBA, International Bar Association, where you have construction and property and corporate. And so do you have the same sort of things in PR, presumably?
Yeah, we do. There's the Chartered Institute of PR is our sort of industry body. And they have regular networking sessions and conferences. They produce reports, provide training on best practice. But I think, yeah, that's the thing with PR, is it's such a wide-ranging industry, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Everyone's heard of PR, but I think not that many people, unless you work either in PR or you work with people, you have PR, as it were, PR support. But people maybe don't have that firm of a grasp of what it actually entails.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people I can say, we have a PR firm, Farrah Kane does all our work, and people say, what's PR? You know, what does it do? And I explain. And then is the use of PR in this country more than other countries, do you know? I only ask because I was just speaking to Larry Beagle, who's a lawyer in California, and I think I've said to him, and they don't really have the same extent of use of PR there. I just wonder what you're...
Again, I don't know exactly. The one thing I would say is that the UK has a particularly deep and well-developed media landscape.
Yeah.
I think PR goes beyond just media relations, but that is certainly a key part of it. And that's what keeps us busy on a daily basis. So I think probably one of the reasons there's such a widespread use of PR in the UK is just because we also have such a deep media landscape. But I mean, I think, you know, a lot of American law firms will also have PR agencies.
I think bigger firms too.
So I think it's fairly well established, certainly in the US. I know Australia, again, for instance, has quite a deep PR industry. But beyond the Anglophone world, as it were, I'm honestly not really sure. But I would think so.
And how many newspapers and that do you have to read? I should declare again for the listener, my future son-in-law works for a totally different PR agency, and I know that he has sort of newspapers every day. Is that the same for you? There are journals and magazines you're reading every day? And
yeah, I mean, I certainly would say very rare is the day that goes by where I don't read at least all of the national newspapers. But it's not, you know, we're reading them online now, really. We do still pick up print copies, especially if we're expecting a particular article to appear.
Yeah.
But by and large, it's reading newspapers online. So there's not really the same opportunity to read them cover to cover.
Right.
As you once would have done. But, I mean, as an agency, what we do is we have the whole team reads a newspaper each in the morning. And then the sort of key stories that are picked up from that are sent round.
Oh, okay.
So we have an agency-wide email address that's actually called Media Monitoring, because its principal purpose is to send round those sort of media monitoring reports from the morning so that everyone starts their day with
it's that big share.
Exactly. With a firm knowledge of what the headlines are that day.
And how do you manage to distance yourself from the law? Because I know a lot of people who stopped reading newspapers because of, you know, misinformation and bias, and also just the negative output of news. You know, there's probably the sort of front page or so where that isn't, where it's just new, sort of more news report. How do you sort of inure yourself from that overwhelming sort of news every day?
I don't know if I do. I mean, I love the news. I've sort of always loved the news ever since I used to watch Channel 4 News every day.
Yeah, probably the best.
Not necessarily out of choice as a sort of 7 or 8 year old.
Okay.
But when my dad would get home from work, he would put Channel 4 News on. And as he paid for most of the bills, it was thought that it was fair enough that he would get to choose what to watch in the evening. So we'd watch Channel 4 News. To be honest, I think that was a real high point for Channel 4 News. I don't think it's quite as good a program as it was, say...
it's his heyday.
10, 15 years ago. But, I mean, I think, you know, the news is fantastic. I love being able to just know what's going on in the world.
But equally, I find it quite hard when I... we won't get too sidetracked. When you read about Trump, and without going, but there's so many things I just find so utterly frustrating and about that. And then, or you read about Ukraine or Gaza and these, you know, just depressing. So how do you feel about, I will ask one because I do find it interesting. How do you feel, bearing in mind, you're in PR, and then you're writing articles that you are helping those of us to write articles and presenting them as a factual basis or an opinion piece. How do you regard the modern increase in completely sort of untrue, or where people, you know, particularly certain people, just say stuff that is clearly inaccurate, or where they're really twisting. Is that? Do you think that's going to be a long term difficulty in sort of misrepresentation of historical information?
Potentially, but I think people, at least when you're talking about mainstream news, I think the idea that you can't trust the newspapers, I don't personally buy into, because there's, you know, if you read a newspaper, you can find the corrections page where anytime they get something wrong and someone's pointed out to them, they're obliged to correct it. So in terms of, you know, trusting the news, I do trust the news. I think there is a lot of stuff out there on the internet that isn't necessarily very reputable.
Yeah.
But in terms of mainstream major news organizations, you know, they're actually quite heavily regulated.
Yeah.
And also, I think if you read all of the newspapers, you get a pretty good sense of what the actual news is from each of their
and their respective
plans.
Angles.
Exactly. And, you know, everyone knows The Guardian has a more left-wing take on things. The Telegraph has a more right-wing take on things. So that, you know, you're not going to read those newspapers and be astonished to discover a yes, right-wing opinion in the Telegraph. So I don't find a problem with that. And in terms of the earlier point you were making about, you know, there being plenty of bad news in the world, but that's all happening anyway, so I'd rather know about it than not, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's a very good answer, because we are now overwhelmed with news, aren't we? You know, I can when I grew up, I'm pretty sure we had a newspaper delivered, and then as you grew up, there was a fluctuating view of, you know, whether you got a newspaper. I was brought up with the Torygraph, Telegraph, and the Times, and for a long time, we subscribed to the Times, and I just became fed up of their particular view. I now have the Guardian online, and as you say, it's a very different piece, isn't it, now from having a newspaper on your phone. Do you still occasionally get the real thing out? I do like the tactile.
My parents have the FT weekend delivered.
Right.
So when I'm back if I'm back staying at theirs for a weekend, I'll leaf through it. I don't so often think to pick up a copy myself, but I subscribe to, you know, a good number of newspapers, just sort of my personal life, as it were. So I kind of view an opportunity to read them on my laptop. Yeah. That's almost like reading the news properly in my mind,
right,
rather than scrolling through it on your phone. So that you know, like if there's a long read, for instance, that I'm particularly keen to digest, if I see it on my phone, I'll send myself the link and then read it on my laptop.
All right, okay.
So I can read it properly, because I kind of don't like that sort of...
I do like that. It's interesting because the Guardian has long links. And one of the things I really like about modern news is your ability to share.
Mm.
You know, that you can now send a link to an article we've got a family WhatsApp group, I'm sure pretty much everybody has. But I do like the fact that you can share something and you can comment on it either way as you send it, can't you? You can say, you know, this is a great article or this is a load of rubbish, and I like the fact that you don't have to all be in the same mindset, but you share something and you can get that feedback. That's quite a change, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think as well, there's some absolutely fantastic journalism out there, which is perhaps not... There was probably, I suppose, a kind of sweet spot where all of the newspapers had gone online, but they hadn't put up paywalls yet, where everyone was reading the news for free, which I think possibly slightly obscured the fact that actually it's quite hard work being a journalist. So it's probably, you know, paying for your news is worthwhile because it allows them to keep producing it. But I think one of the good things about all the papers being online now is it's given them more opportunities to write more sort of esoteric news, or not even really news articles, but more, I suppose, what would have once only appeared in the weekend magazines. But, I was reading a fantastic piece in the New York Times quite recently, which is, I think, my favourite newspaper, actually.
Okay.
Also one of the best resourced. So they produce all sorts of great journalism. But it was quite a long article about how people feel when their therapist passes away and they didn't expect them to. And it's like, you'd never think about what that feels like. But it was a really moving, really interesting piece. And it was, you know, there was interviews with people whose therapist had died and just how they felt about it, but also reporting on what sort of therapist associations are doing to deal with the therapists do die. So, as you know, I've found out about something that I never would have expected, and I think that I was just scrolling through Twitter or Instagram or something on my way home, and I just thought, oh, that looks interesting, which is the more positive side of social media. There's all these
just pull up things
exactly, and it just, oh, that looks interesting, I'll read that. And actually, I think newspapers, for instance, are still producing a lot of that really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I haven't thought of... I should have a look at the New York Times, because I do... There was one I had online from America, but it wasn't New York Times. It was another one. But I think you're right. It's interesting to get a different perspective. And why are they so well-resourced?
I think they have quite a lot of money behind them, a lot of subscribers, I mean, America's just a big,
I suppose,
big rich country, and I think that's probably the biggest, richest newspaper there.
Right.
So I think it's as simple as they just have the most money, so they employ the most journalists.
And you're right, it does give you the opportunity to have, as you say, esoteric articles that are on sort of whimsical things, aren't
they? Yeah.
But they are, I think that's where I really enjoy. I read an article the other day, oh no, it's semi-depressing about, it was on climate change, but it was a guy, it was part of a much longer sort of paper about human action and how every X millennia there's this, you know, huge intervening event, and everyone thought it was all from meteorites hitting the Earth, but it wasn't just from that, it was volcanoes erupting. But the span of the article was interesting because it was talking about this last happened, I can't remember how many years ago, but this particular bout of time, there were volcanoes and that erupting, he said, for 200 years, which is a long time. And the catastrophic event arose because into the 300th year of this cataclysmic stuff going on, the lava underneath the ground had become so prolific and so hot, it basically started burning all the coal and calcium and limestone in the ground. And it was this that produced these huge toxic flumes that actually then caused the particular ice age. And I think this was 60 million years ago. But it was a really interesting article because it went further than, you know, just climate change and gave you an historical perspective. But it was also beautifully written. And I do enjoy, it's not Mills and Boon, but it's...
No,
it's
well...
It's almost sort of clicky bait in the articles.
Yeah, well, I think that's the other thing, and this is something that you quite, I suppose people in my profession might quite regularly say to clients, which is that, and I think actually journalists say a lot as well, journalists don't write headlines. Sub-editors write headlines.
Okay.
So you must always read past the headline, because the headline will be the most... clickbaity thing it can be, because that is the point of a headline, is to get you to read the article. But it's not always necessarily a very accurate reflection of what then follows. So I would say if I've learned one thing about the media, it's always read past the headline.
I caught the end of it was something on the radio the other day, and they were talking about one of the former editors of the Sun, and saying that editor or sub-editor, that they wrote most of those, you know, gotcha
yeah.
headlines and that. But they said, you know, that was their skill. Pretty much all they did was, you know, someone presented an article, they'd read the article, and they just had this ability to just like,
yeah,
in a word or two. And that's, you know, I haven't even seen a copy of The Sun, but I don't know if it still does those headlines. But that of its era, that's what The Sun was known for, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't write headlines for love nor money. I think of myself as quite a good writer, but I can't do headlines. I can't do headlines and I can't do poetry. Those are my two big failings as a writer. But yeah, there's a very particular skill to kind of writing something that is capturing the whole article, but also will make people want to read it.
Yeah, you really shouldn't look at it as a failing. I'm not into any of that sort of. Shouldn't allow yourself to be negative. You write beautifully, and I'm sure if you, for some reason, had to dedicate yourself to poetry, you would. I find it interesting that you say you can't write headlines, because I hadn't really thought about it, but it's different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very, I think, particular skill, because it's not really like any other form of writing.
We have that in the law. In contracts are different from pleadings. And we frequently have to explain, or not frequently, normally, have to explain to clients that the way a legal submission for the court is written is not the same as a contractual document. And I write contract documents, and I write, obviously, letters and emails, you know, thousands and thousands of words every day. But I So it's, you know, when you pause, think about it. But I don't draft pleadings. I can. I don't think they're as good as counsel. I can do them. But if I do, I have to really, really think into a different, completely different mindset, because it's the sort of the synapse and the formulation of sentences is quite different. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, but yeah, we have similar things. When you're writing an article or editing things, does it always sort of, is it quite easy, or do you sometimes sit there, as I have had, where you know the waste paper basket is full, and I still often do it in paper, full of, you know, that I've written three words on a piece of paper and it's just rubbish. You can't get your head into it.
Absolutely. It doesn't always come easily. Sometimes, and there's, I think being tired has a big role to play. You know, if you've not got a good night's sleep, for instance, that's, I think, because it's quite, I can't really think of the right way, but I think when you're writing well, you're almost in a sort of flow state where you just almost see what the sentence should look like in your mind as you're writing it. But I think that requires you to be quite alert and on your game. And sometimes, you know, like when that burst of hot weather we had, when I don't think anyone in the country was sleeping well, I reckon the quality of everyone's written communication
probably dropped
because you've got to be, yeah, I think to, you know, and it, also some topics you're more comfortable writing about than others. Some audiences you're more familiar with what
do you find it? Do you find it hard to adapt between the different audiences that you know, say for the various sort of industry type magazines? Is that something that you can sort of say, oh, right, this is an engineering and this is property, and you can just sort of, you know, click your fingers or whatever? And or again, is that something that you might start writing something and think, oh, no, this is a bit too property or a bit too engineering for this, and you need to...
I think so, yeah. From practice, you get better at it, certainly, but it is not always straightforward. Or sometimes, you know, you might have two articles to draft back to back almost.
Right.
Or to, you know, edit back to back. And yeah, sometimes you find yourself editing in a way that was right for the first one, but wrong for the second one. But I think that probably the skill that you learn over time is recognizing as you're doing it.
Yeah.
That's not quite, you know, you've not got it quite right.
I do like your comment about a flow state. I recognise that because if I'm drafting something, I sometimes can get straight into it, and other times it just can be if I've drafting contract from scratch. Sometimes it can just be hours. I can do all the sort of boilerplate type clauses, but the main bits I can spend hours and just not getting there. There's some connection, and then suddenly, as you say, I can start writing and I can start seeing in my head where I want to go
I think usually the thing is, if you can, which, you know, sometimes in a professional environment you can't, is to step away from it for a few hours or come back to it the next day. Because I think actually having that distance from it usually helps. Then you start to think, because it's still in your mind, you start to think, oh, that's what I wanted to say there, or that's the way I wanted to write that sentence, in a way that actually when you're just trying to do it, and it, you know, does as it sometimes does, it feels like you're slightly banging your head against the wall.
Yeah.
Stopping and letting the ideas come to you rather than trying to force them out.
I was going to say, as you said, it's flow, isn't it, rather than force. It's
flow rather than force is a lovely way of describing it.
Yeah. And so you went to university in Warwick. You mentioned before the family Kent, but you've spent your working life in London. How do you see London sort of developing and changing over the next few years? Do you see more people? You must have seen a difference in the time you've been at work with more people working from home. You know, I go to London still on a regular basis, and if I say to people I'm meeting on a Monday or Friday, there's nobody there. How do you see sort of London's the city evolving through this, or do you think it will come back to everybody working in the offices? Or
I mean, Mondays I think are already on the way back. So I mean, at Varicane we're hybrid, so we do 3 days in, 2 days home. But what we don't do is you can't do Monday and Friday,
right?
Which I think works actually really nicely because it means it's never completely dead on Monday and Friday. There's always people around. I really like working in the office on a Friday. I like coming in, but that is partly because the city is a bit quieter on Fridays. But it's there's a nice atmosphere actually too. So I live in Leighton, which is just north of Stratford, our office is based in Farringdon.
Yes.
So Leighton's pretty busy on a Friday because there's more people working from home, and whereas Farringdon in more in the centre is comparatively quiet. But they're both still in London. There's still people around, and I imagine. My dad lives in my parents live in Berkhamsted in Hertfordshire,
which
is a big commuter town. Yeah. I imagine Berkhamsted's busier now on a Friday.
My godmother used to live there, but Berkhamsted. Yeah, but it's a different vibe, isn't it? The days, it's quite funny, London.
It is. I mean, I don't want to be a cliche, but it's a brilliant city.
I agree.
I feel very fortunate to live there. In a way I didn't necessarily appreciate having grown up on the doorstep.
Yeah. And you've come up to Leeds today, which is fantastic. And it's your first time in Leeds.
First time in Leeds, but hopefully not my last time.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean I've not got to experience masses of the city. But from what I've seen, big fan.
Good.
Seems like a fantastic place. Very friendly.
Yeah.
Very friendly, which I know the North has its reputation for. What I should do actually is visit more of the UK. I was recently in, and this is a bit strange, but I was in Arundel to see a jousting tournament.
I was going to say at the castle.
But it was real jousting.
Yeah. I wish you can do here.
Yeah, well, I noticed the Royal Irish. Yeah. That's actually what made me think of it. I was thinking, sometimes I think living in England or the UK, you forget that actually there's so many lovely places in the UK that you wouldn't think of visiting because, that's the country I already live in.
Well, as an example, did you go to Warwick Castle when you were at Warwick?
Yes, but
you bucked the trend.
only very much in passing. But the problem is Warwick University is nowhere near Warwick Castle.
Yeah,
because it's outside Coventry, but they didn't want to call it Coventry.
No,
University.
They didn't.
So it should be called the University of Warwickshire.
Yes. Yeah, no, it is a very good point. If people don't know, you are... Well, I think one of my sons has walked home from Coventry to university, and it certainly isn't anywhere near Warwick.
If you do like castles and you're at Warwick University, you're right on the doorstep of Kenilworth Castle.
Which is amazing.
Which is a fantastic castle.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I went to prep school in Warwick. And, I didn't feel it at the time, but my parents... when they came to see me weekends, would often take me to a castle, which, as I say, at the time, didn't probably appreciate it, but I should have done. Anyway, Jim, I'm really glad that you came up today. It was brilliant to be able to talk to you in person. I hope you've enjoyed it. You've been a fantastic guest. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm sort of... First time speaker, long time listener. So.
Well, I think you're a natural speaker, so you should be very, very pleased.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.